Cyber war. A conflict fought without foot soldiers, guns, or missiles. Instead, attacks are launched by computer hackers, digital spy rings, information thieves, cyber armies of kids, criminals, terrorists, some backed by nation states. In the United States, there's a growing concern that they pose a massive threat to national security and a conviction that the world's military superpower needs to be prepared for the fight ahead. I'm Josh Rushing, and on this week's Fault Lines, we ask, are the reports of cyber threats distorting reality? And are the battles being waged in cyberspace interfering with the internet as we know it?
Case scenario is an attack on our networks that would take down critical infrastructure, something that took down our power grid, or something that took down our air traffic control system or one of our critical defense systems. Something like that would paralyze the country, could cause loss of life, would cause enormous economic damage, and would be very difficult to restore in a short period of time.
The Senate itself was just attacked 1,800,000 times each and every day.
We're not discussing theory here.
The U.S. government is attacked over 1 billion times every single day.
It's a new form of warfare. It's a new form of how do you disrupt infrastructure.
There are attacks on our networks every single day that come from multiple sources around the world.
It's now clear this cyber threat is one of the most serious economic and national security challenges we face as a nation.
President Obama is putting money where his mouth is, allocating more than $350 million of federal government spending this year to securing infrastructure, and substantial but undisclosed amounts more to national intelligence budgets. And he's appointed a cybersecurity coordinator at the White House. But in the halls of Congress, there's an audible anxiety that neither the government nor the private sector is moving fast enough.
The government hasn't gotten its act together. The private sector, which is 90% of it, has its problems in getting its act together.
The Cybersecurity Act of 2010 is one of several pieces of legislation being discussed on Capitol Hill. A rare bipartisan effort, and the product of more than a year's negotiation between U.S. lawmakers and the private sector companies that own and operate the vast majority of networked infrastructure in the United States. The bill requires the president and private sector work together to develop a joint response in the event of a cybersecurity emergency and share classified and confidential information about threats and attacks.
So that cooperation is going to be indispensable and crucial if we are to avert a cyber calamity of epic proportions.
You know, it is an act of terrorism, but it beats other forms of act of terrorism. It's just absolutely extraordinary to me and very discouraging. And that's why we want this out and we want it acted on.
New fears require new faces. And the United States has turned east to find them. Armies of hackers, criminals, and government-backed cyber warriors in China and Russia are taking shape in the American imagination as a new kind of red threat.
The primary threat comes from other nation states and from the intelligence services of a few countries. The Chinese are good. They have a lot of people and a lot of money. There are a few other countries that do this as well. The Russians have been doing this for a long time. They're very good.
Jim Lewis is at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
The second threat would be cybercrime. There's a few countries that are sanctuaries for cybercrime, and unfortunately it would be Russia and China again, in part because cybercriminals can be proxies, they can be mercenaries. So the government doesn't want to do it. They ask their cybercriminal friends to help them out.
Now the cyber battle has heated up.
And that's the story the U.S. media is latched onto.
Google alleges that Chinese hackers broke into the email accounts of several of its users.
In January, Google, the world's largest internet search company, announced that its networks had been breached by attacks that originated in China.
With ties to China, and may cause a serious ripple effect.
The Chinese use some fairly basic techniques to exploit vulnerabilities in the networks of Google and 30 other companies. This was not just Google. To get in and, in Google's case, do two things. Steal intellectual property, how Google's search engines work, and look for information on Tibetan human rights activists and things like Gmail.
Gmail accounts were compromised, presumably of human rights activists and workers, and possibly some source code.
And what they did is they exploited a vulnerability in Internet Explorer that allowed them to get inside the company. But they were not financially oriented. They were probably more looking to find future opportunities for exploitation and potentially more politically motivated.
The attacks also targeted more than 30 other companies, many of them major players in Silicon Valley, the heartland of the U.S. internet technology industry. We traveled here to speak with the CEO of Symantec, a company rumored to have been among the victims. The head of the biggest internet security provider in the world sees a silver lining in the attacks and in Google's unusual decision to make them public.
What these attacks have done is they've raised awareness that the threat is real. You'd expect us as a provider of technology or solutions to tell you the threat is real. I think in this case, what you saw was companies that had nothing to gain, and the government, which has nothing to gain by, let's say, creating a fear or panic, is saying the threat is real.
The U.S. State Department backed Google with a strong but carefully worded warning, telling the Chinese government to investigate the attacks.
Countries or individuals that engage in cyber attacks should face consequences and international condemnation.
China responded with outrage, calling the veiled accusation groundless.
In some ways, the Chinese couldn't have picked a worse company to hit because Google was the favorite child of this administration. So, big mistake. They should have gone after somebody else.
So was the Chinese government responsible? It's the kind of question that plagues cybersecurity experts. They call it the attribution problem, and it makes responding to attacks inherently difficult. Since hackers can commandeer computers to attack others remotely, it's hard to determine where they're based, and tougher still to determine who they're working for. Ron Diebert's team at the University of Toronto's Citizen Lab spent almost a year investigating GhostNet, an espionage operation that targeted Tibetan organizations, including the offices of the Dalai Lama. He says that in both the case of GhostNet and the Google attacks, the evidence he's seen that the Chinese state is responsible is inconclusive.
This could be individuals, it could be criminal organizations, it could even be another country staging the attacks as if they're coming from China. And we have to be very careful about all of these possibilities.
With what looks like binary code blinking outside, you might think that this was a software company. It's actually a consultancy in Washington, D.C., run by Michael Chertoff. He spent 4 years in the Bush administration as the Secretary of Homeland Security, responsible for securing U.S. civilian and private sector networks. Now he advises government and corporate clients about cybersecurity issues. In short, his views have currency. Chertoff says the attribution problem is one of the reasons the U.S. government is still struggling to come up with a coherent cybersecurity policy.
How are you? Good to see you. How are you?
We haven't ever really developed or discussed what our policy would be if there was an attack. Would we retaliate? Would we take out the attack server? Would we use physical as opposed to cyber means to respond?
Could there be the kind of situation where you have a cyber attack from one country and a kinetic response from the U.S.?
Sure, that's not out of the question. Imagine that country A attacks and seriously affects our systems. And in order to remove the servers, first we go to the country and say, you've got to shut down the server. And the country either says, we can't or we won't. Or we don't have the ability to do so. Now, then we'd have to decide, how do we shut down the server? Do we do it virtually by going back over the network? Would it be easier to send a group of special forces in and blow the server up?
Black ops sabotage on sovereign soil with U.S. special forces? And this is starting to sound like real war. It raises the question and the stakes. If U.S. networks are attacked thousands of times a day, does that mean war has already begun? Were the attacks on Google an act of war?
It's not war. Spying on other people to get technology and to find out what's happening politically, that's espionage.
You know, there is a concept of cyber war, but we haven't really defined it yet. And you really have to break it into two categories. One is espionage or theft of information. The second category are circumstances where you actually have an attack on the system. So both of these are dimensions of what could be called cyber warfare. But the line between cyber warfare and criminal activity in cyberspace is a little bit indefinite.
So the answer right now depends on who's calling the shots.
The concern you have is that we're not going to take the hard decisions in this area until we have the equivalent of a Pearl Harbor or 9/11. You know, something will actually result in loss of life or a huge dislocation of our economy. And it would be a pity if it required something so dramatic to result in moving forward.
While people like Michael Chertoff warn of scenarios on the scale of 9/11 and Pearl Harbor, an entire industry is growing at a breathtaking rate. Here at a government security conference in Washington, there's a dizzying number of players getting in the game. U.S. military contractors like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman are competing for tens of billions of dollars in U.S. defense and intelligence contracts. Smaller players here are vying for a piece of the action, too. And their language is the language of war.
I'm going to take out the zombie that's attacking. I don't know if it's the botnet head. The kind of strike backs we can do is your shotgun to fight back on your network.
So who we're targeting, the audience for this, again, as John had mentioned, is the United States Department of Defense and U.S. intel agencies. But we're on something extremely hot. In fact, I'm awfully surprised that U.S. intel, the black bands, hadn't showed up around the facility saying, hey, what's going on with this offensive? But it's time to have an offensive capability. The internet is just, it's dangerous out there.
Companies will profit from the sense that it is indeed dangerous out there. So dangerous that new weapons must be invented and a new form of warfare fought.
Well, assessing cybersecurity threats is made inherently difficult right off the bat because of the fact that there is a major private sector around cybersecurity services that has an interest in inflating the threat and benefiting by the estimated $40 to $50 billion that is available in Washington for cybersecurity. So a whole industry has sprouted up around this that has a vested interest in describing this threat in ways that benefit them as a service provider.
And as the threat reports spiral toward conflict, the questions we ask of every war, cyber or conventional, become more pressing. Can it be won? And what would be lost? A new era of warfare. And at the Pentagon, the U.S. military is gearing up. Here, cyber has joined land, sea, and air as a domain of operations. And it's about to get its own command with its very own four-star general overseeing the domain, nominated by President Obama.
I am honored that President Obama and Secretary Gates have placed their trust and confidence in me by nominating me for the position of Director, National Security Agency, Central Security Service, and for Commander, U.S. Cyber Command.
His name is Keith Alexander, and he's the head of the National Security Agency, a job he'll keep alongside his new post.
This command is not about efforts to militarize cyberspace. Rather, it is about safeguarding the integrity of our military's critical information systems.
It's a comforting story. But answers to some crucial questions remain classified, like how many cyber attacks actually originate within the United States, and others are less than direct.
Do you think that a cyber war can exist? Can you define it? If there's no value in having one, is there a need for the U.S. to develop offensive cyber war capabilities? Senator, in general terms, I do think a cyber war could exist. I believe it would not exist in and of itself, but as part of a larger military campaign. And so the issue is, from a military perspective, if these things are impacting our networks today, We have a responsibility to defend those, set up a cybersecurity.
In other words, yes. In the months it's been waiting for General Alexander's confirmation, the U.S. military has been seeking out the best and the brightest, hoping to fill their ranks with cyber warriors, looking high and low for network security specialists, computer engineers, and hackers. Meet Redbeard. He's a hacker.
That is one way of putting that moniker. I would self-identify as a hacker, yes.
Just a couple of months ago, he was working away at his systems administrator job in his Washington, D.C. cubicle. Just another normal day at the office. Until, that is, a naval officer turns up unannounced. The officer was there to try to recruit Redbeard into working for the government as a hacker.
Are you interested in engaging in cyber offensives? In directly doing both defense and offense to threats of the nation? In so much as, like a game of sports, the only good defense is a good offense.
Redbeard said no to the offer.
In the end, I don't want to have on my chest, you know, breaking into a Chinese email server and planting an email that was never sent so that a local asset can say, hey, this guy over there, he's talking to the West. And then this man becomes a desaparecido. I don't need that. You know, that's similar to the firing squad mentality, where some people are able to go, well, I think that I didn't fire the bullet. But you might have. And doing that type of work, you might have been the person that put the bullet in the chamber.
You'll also notice that they'll be all centered around a specific piece of software because they're...
Redbeard would rather see a much more defensive approach to defense.
I think that the actual vector of attack, the actual threats, are coming from unpatched systems and actual administrators who are overworked, administrators who just don't have the resources to actually kind of get their job done. But no amount of banging the drum on that, you know, seems to make a lot of other people care. That's not sexy. That's not exciting.
But more influential voices believe that the United States needs to be able to carry out offensive cyber attacks to dissuade the enemy from attacking in the first place.
Part of that is to have the capability to deter by responding. And either by taking out the attacker or by being able to retaliate. So that suggests you need to have a certain offensive capability. And the key is going to be not just the technology, but to define, in terms of doctrine, what kinds of offensive steps are we willing to take and what kinds are we going to put off limits. And once you understand that, you then have to synchronize the legal regime so that it fits with the doctrine.
The character of cyberspace is changing. I believe there is an arms race in cyberspace. It's being militarized, and that's a very big problem.
As militaries, intelligence agencies, and private companies build their arsenals to defend their networks, the long-term consequences aren't clear. But in the United States, people who have grown up or grown used to communicating freely on the internet may find their rights dissolving into the ether.
How are individuals going to go back to first principles? How are you going to go back?
John Verdi is a lawyer at EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center in Washington.
Because cybersecurity can be implemented in a way that's very respective of the privacy of internet users, mobile phone users, all technology users, people who take advantage of 21st century communications devices, right? Or cybersecurity could alternatively be implemented in a way that results in widespread collection, access, and disclosure of personal information.
Online anonymity, the ability to use the internet without identifying yourself, may soon be a thing of the past.
What will happen is there'll be new ways of establishing trust. There'll be new ways of saying what individuals, what web servers, what companies, what can you trust? And that's kind of the next big frontier, is how do you establish trust on the internet? Because historically, it's been about being anonymous. That's going to have to change.
I would put it a little differently. I would say that we're likely to have several levels of internet, and it's going to depend on how much trust you require. Clearly, for certain kinds of interaction, you're going to need to know who you're dealing with. And people who are unwilling to verify their identity will simply be refused admittance.
The new cyber commander and NSA director has promised the agency won't use the risk of foreign cyber attacks as an excuse to spy on Americans' email conversations. But the illegal wiretapping of U.S. citizens during the Bush administration's so-called war on terror is still fresh in many memories. It doesn't inspire much confidence.
The NSA has done such a bang-up job with warrantless wiretapping, I'm perfectly happy letting them take over the role of cybersecurity. I have complete faith that they won't overstep their bounds.
The agency's new alliances with the private sector are also raising eyebrows. Following the attacks, Google announced it had teamed up with the NSA.
Now, the details of that relationship haven't been made public, but the question that I think immediately arises to folks who follow this issue is Google working with the Signals Intelligence Division, or is Google working with the Information Assurance Division?
Put differently, will the NSA be reading your Gmail, or working to protect Google's networks from intrusions, or both? Epic has taken the NSA to court to find out.
We think that such an important contract and such an important relationship between the biggest internet company in the United States and the biggest internet services provider in the United States and the National Security Agency, a substantial intelligence gathering entity at the U.S. government, should be made public and should be more transparent.
Cyberspace is changing. There's little doubt. And the U.S. reaction to the challenge is guided by a metaphor, that of war. Foreign enemies attack. Cyber warriors defend, deter, and design offensive weapons. It's a simple way of translating technological, legal, and cultural complexity for a broad audience. But metaphors can become reality. And in the fog of war, facts get hidden and rights are taken away. So is war the right metaphor?
The United States has seen the limitations of using war as a metaphor for how we handle illegal drugs. We've seen it at the limitations as a metaphor for how we handle our foreign policy post 9/11. The warfare metaphor here doesn't strike me as particularly useful.
Given the political power of the military-industrial complex, and with billions of dollars already pumping into a new sector of the defense industry, is it too late for the United States to take a different approach? Or is it still possible to choose a new metaphor?
So all of these terms are discrete components that exist as sides on a Rubik's Cube. And depending on your perspective, and depending on the spin that you're trying to put on it, you shift them into the exact verbiage in the exact lexicon that you want to present.
Many decades from now, people could look back at this period and say, that was a very rare moment, the period from the 1990s to 2010, where there was this global communications platform that just disintegrated. And so that's why many of us, and I'm not alone here, are advocating for a kind of internet protection movement, because we need to protect and preserve cyberspace as an open public commons.